miss you when I
back, everyone. For today, I'm actually joined with my friend Sabrina. We're going to discuss Dale Cooper through what we see in Scott Frost's book, My Life, My Tape, and even a little bit in Fire Walk With Me. But before we get into that, I'll hand over the mic so she can introduce herself further.
Hey, this is Sabrina. I've just been a big fan of Twin Peaks for a couple of years now, and I'm excited to be here.
And I guess to start off with talk about My Life, My Tapes, I really have to stress the fact that Scott Frost, who actually did a couple episodes in the original series, like, he really nailed the characterization of Dale Cooper to a T from the events of 1967 up until 1989. Before we get into the book itself, was there anything you had in mind for the characterization of Cooper?
I mean, Coop is a fundamentally damaged man whose trauma has led his core to just pave the way to what we see in the character. He is a man that is light of spirit, heavy of heart, and tortured of mind. And it all adds up to this very unique character that is so interesting that it's just, you don't get tired of him.
I would agree. And I think that actually just the entries alone in 1967, it feels like it says almost everything we need to know about Cooper from this point on, because on Christmas Day of 67, he receives his first recorder. He talks about his poster of the FBI story, the Jimmy Stewart film, his father having a bad experience with religion when he was younger. Even that 2 days after having the tape recorder, he starts planning his life in a very serious manner, and actually includes it concludes in the year that his mother has dreams and visions, including her impending death, which I feel like really will permeate the book from this point on. Anything about the year of 1967 that should be thought about as the tone that's going to set for Cooper?
So, other than that, there was a lot going on. The first year of the book really just kind of set the foundation for his analytical nature, and he dances around a lot of targeting emotion rather than analyzing emotion. So it is very easy for an analytical mind to take an emotion and try and break down the emotion rather than to feel the emotion, which I think he deals with a lot further in life. But as far as 67 is concerned, I think it was laying a foundation for that kind of nature.
Oh, yeah. No, I absolutely agree. And without any hesitation, in 1968, it's actually on New Year's Day where Bradley's bike, I think it's like, if it's not missing, it's just outright stolen. And in the process of trying to find the three guys that were a part of it, Cooper actually loses his tape recorder, gets it back later when the gang is arrested. But that's the time when he realizes he needs to be better equipped to fight crime. And actually, it's also not long after that he writes to Ephraim Zimbalist, star of the ABC show The FBI from, I believe it was 65 to 74. But he writes him a letter about what authority to enroll in. And the thing is that Ephraim, I forget what he wrote. You know, when he does write back, he does give him an autograph, which he shows to all the kids. And I think there's something that's really just interesting about just his love for the FBI, just from such a young age and with that enthusiasm.
It definitely shows the enthusiasm, but even around that time, he was conducting his own experiments, i.e. the P experiment. So it shows not just the sense of justice, but deductive ability. And it's in a funny, fun kid's way, but not just this interest in justice and this sense of right and wrong, but a sense of wanting to know more about the world and explore it. And that curiosity that is so fundamental to him is just, it's a core aspect that they express right off the bat.
And actually, the one thing that's kind of a strange contrast is that it's around this point where he has a certain conflict about the law when a draft dodger is introduced at the school. And this will be subsequently be a prominent part when his brother Emmett goes to Canada to avoid the draft. Yeah, that's an interesting part about this part of My Life, My Tapes, that there's a lot of socio-political turmoil that's just permeating throughout the late 60s and early 70s for Cooper. They step away from it as the book goes on, but I think that's really interesting how how that a lot of that will dictate not only his feelings for like positions of authority, but also even for love interests as the as it goes on.
Yeah, I think how the Vietnam War affected a lot of the generation is reflected in his own like generational trauma because of this beginning of this confliction with authority in that way, of there being draft dodgers and of the movements that arise because of that and the blatant loss and grief that affected his own town, his friends, his neighbors, because of the Vietnam War and because of what happened there, and because of his own father's trauma in World War II, which affected his own ability to deal with things because not only was his father traumatized, but his mom was traumatized in her own way. So both of them are suffering from different mental health issues that he has to balance and cope with as a child.
It's interesting because during this time, the Vietnam Wars talk about Martin Luther King, RFK. In fact, actually, when Bobby Kennedy's train comes through, that's when he has his first kiss. It's actually with a who I think is a very important character, Marie. And the things that's worth mentioning that this is Bradley's sister. But the most bizarre part when I reread this book is that when she's introduced, she's wearing a red wig and is dancing, quote unquote, very strangely. Now, I'm not going to say that Lynch was inspired by this when he had Will Firewalk with me, but I will say this is such a strange part that just retroactively fits in with Cooper. Again, I think the whole it just retroactively fits in. That's kind of where I start and end with it, but I have to ask what you think of this particular scene.
So, with that particular scene, I think it was more of just like a little nod and like a dancing very strangely and the red wig. It was very I believe it was a kind of just a nod to the what happened, but also there are so many layers upon layers upon of interconnectivity with these characters in the Twin Peaks mythos and trees that having these things that you see that it's like, wait, that happened before happens so often that it's just, do these things overlap? Is this the universe repeating itself in certain ways, or were things always meant to be the way that they were meant to be?
I think what's so interesting is that this book, it came out in it was May of 1991, which theoretically, if season two wasn't nearly canceled and then postponed, it would have been right after the season two finale. Then the thing that's what's worth addressing is that Fire Walk With Me, it didn't get written until summer of 91, and it's probably worth addressing at Lynch, even though unrelated book, but with The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. He's never read the book, as far as Jennifer Lynch has discussed in interviews, but he was very insistent on having her. So it's just like a very strange little thing that just fits in with like one of Cooper's characters that also fits in with another, like, I'll save it for a little episode, but I think she kind of is like a strange decoder for Fire Walk With Me. And just, I'm just like astounded by that, how those two parallels could actually coincide in such a short span.
I wouldn't say I'm surprised, honestly, when it comes to Lynch. If he can drop something that is like a familiar type of thing, like with him, if you see something that sparks a familiarity, it's probably on purpose for some reason. So a lot of when it comes to that, I think is a deja vu. Like it's supposed to be induce some sort of deja vu, but micro enough where you don't know when you feel that sort of loss and being of lo lost in a way until you find it, but then you don't know why. And I think that that feeling of not knowing why, but knowing there's, but seeing a connection is very, I don't know, that it's something that I've come to feel a lot with this the whole franchise of Twin Peaks is like, oh, that's a connection. I don't know why it is, and I want to go further down this rabbit hole, but I don't see anything. It's too dark. I don't have a light.
In the case of Will, or in the case of Marie, better yet, I think this is one where we'll probably have to revisit because I would say out of all the romantic interest for Cooper, this is the most important one in this whole book. So I think the whole red wig, even if, whether it is associated with Lil or not, that's always one thing, but we'll come back to it. But I have to mention is that while we do get the first tremendous loss in Cooper's life in March of 1968, it also has a scene that it gets a little too Twin Peaksy in the wrong way because his grandmother dies in March of a stroke while baking the kitchen. It's worth addressing that Dell's mother had a vision about this, but my only caveat with the scene is that they had to have the cherry pie tipped over on her face. And I really hate to use this analogy, but this is sort of like the equivalent in Solo: A Star Wars Story, where they had to explain how Han Solo got his name. Like, we did not need this connection in any way, shape, or form. It's really just my only criticism in the book, like from the outset. But whether it's about the cherry pie part or the grandmother's death or the mother's visions, did you have any particular thoughts of what this means for Cooper onward?
I mean, like, when I focus on that scene with the grandmother's death, my focus is more on the fact that his mom is like, you need to touch this to know how death is and how death feels. I don't know what the exact quote is, but she has him like touch his grandmother when she is passed. And I think that given the characterization that we've had for the mom of being of having bad dreams of in the dossier, it explains that, oh, she was mentally unstable in a way. It's like, no, she was mentally sound. She was just mentally troubled. So this was a very healthy way of approaching death for it to introduce it to Dale, of being like, this death is a part of life. You need to, this is not anything that is wrong. It's not anything that's bad. It's just something that is. And I think that approach for the mom was very, very good of her to do as a mom for her son to be able to deal with that.
I would actually fully agree with that. I would even say that, not that she would be the equivalent, but if I had to make a comparison, I would say Dale's mother is almost like the Margaret Lanterman of My Life, My Tapes, where she's very well attuned to the present world and what's beyond it because of her visions. And that, like, she wouldn't say this, even if it seems unconventional from like a ground level, that there's a wider universe that she's seeing out there.
And she knows that Dale is a part of that universe with his own dreams.
I know we were mentioned before, but we were mentioning about how after RFK's train goes through and Cooper has his first kiss, it's only a couple days later that that's when he decides fully to become an FBI agent. And then also he writes a letter to Hoover, who was head of the FBI at the time. And Hoover wrote back a couple weeks later and invited him on a tour and even said that he wishes there were more agents like him and wants to meet him. And actually, Cooper, not that it's related to Hoover at this point, but he does go to a shooting range and he actually ends up, he goes to learn more, but he's actually the one that gives the special agent who's there some good advice on how to shoot. This will be a thing is that there's times where he's very acute and very, his intellect is like unparalleled. And this is actually one of the first times it shows he's a good fit for the FBI.
Yes, I so that part of the book is where I'm like, that was a little hammy considering he's like what, 14? Probably and has never held a pistol or a gun of that caliber before, I believe at that point. But it does say, if we look at it a different way, it does say a lot about his intuitive nature, because that is a major part of his good, like he's very intelligent and he's very in tune with being an FBI agent, but his intuitive nature is a focal point in what drives a lot of his cases to completion. It's what drives a lot of like the Twin Peaks show itself, where he is following this intuition. And we see this in Fire Walk With Me, even at the trailer park, where he's not going to where these other people went. He's following this intuition, which we could relate that, even the shooting of the gun, to this intuition, because being able to handle something physically, having this matter intuition, this analytical nature with this intuition, I think is a key point to his success as an agent.
And actually, one thing that's kind of contributing to maybe not necessarily the FBI, but some that we see in season one at least is that It shows before 1968 is over that his Uncle Al shows him how to count cards. And I think that what I like about this scene is that obviously it's a tie back to the season one finale, but I think of how Cooper, how he can use that to make money. Because in the season one finale, he just says it with full confidence that, the FBI let him borrow this money and he's going to bring back tenfold or so. But I think that what I like about it is that it kind of shows that, when we see Mr. C in the return and how he's basically the billionaire that's been facilitating like the experiment in New York City and having all this stuff around the world. I think it shows that if Cooper really leaned harder into that aspect in his life, and not just the doppelganger, that he could have very easily become like, extraordinarily rich at a young age. And but he always like had his ethics supersede anything like that.
I mean, we see throughout even My Life, My Tapes that he has a lot of skills that he's developed that could lead him to be successful in many areas. I mean, even with, like, I don't know if we're going to get to this later, but like knife throwing, trying to join the circus, or counting cards, he could have gone down that. It could have led to different avenues, but it, like, his destiny kind of streamlines him to a governmental, or at least he has too much of a sense of justice to let things lie. So even if he didn't become, if he became like, successful in one way, he probably would end up a vigilante of some sort because he cannot let lie wrongs that he sees.
Yeah, we really see that where he gets I don't know if contentious is the right word, but he's very firm in his opinion to Doc Hayward in season two when they're talking about Leland when he confirms that he killed Jacques Renault. And we also see him even like that after Leland's death to Major Briggs about his authority. It's his duty in the FBI to see it to the very end. So I think you're onto something in terms of like how he leans in too hard on these sort of principles. But actually, the next part I do have, however, is that, maybe before the return, I would have been critical and thought this is a shoehorned aspect, but I think it fits in perfectly because throughout the late 1968 and early 1969, he has a dream about Bob, and his mother actually confides in him that she has similar dreams and tells him to not let him in. And I don't think it's necessarily a coincidence that Cooper's been, as of early 1969, that he's been sick and has had more dreams about Bob.
Do we want to say that is Bob?
I actually think it is because I know that Bob, if we're going to go with, I guess, say a chronological order, that of course, he uses Leland as a host from a young age. But the way I look at it is that because of reading this after the return, I kind of look at it as almost like an ill-fated destiny for Cooper because once we get to the season two finale, up until really part 18 of the return, we have Mr. C, who's like a dominant part of like the I guess the material world for Cooper because Cooper's trapped in the Black Lodge for 25 years. But meanwhile, we have Mr. C, and the way I view Mr. C is that it's a partnership with him and Bob, where Bob could feasibly just kind of go off and do his own thing, but because he has this evil doppelganger of a man with keen intellect, they both have mutual benefits of just sticking together. So I think that there's this whole not letting him in that just kind of just at least ties into that in some capacity for me.
So what I would say is that Bob is a singularity in a conglomerate. And I'm going to bring this back to the giant barf that we saw come from that being in the return, is that Bob was just one tiny aspect of it. And that is that, like, can we really say that Bob is just one group? What was just is a like the great evil? Or can we open up the door to say Bob was just the great evil of Twin Peaks and that there is more to that? That there is more, or there's even Bob as a singularity, and then there's subdivisions of Bob, such as the doppelgangers, such as the woodsmen, that these are aspects of evil and that there is more than just Bob, that maybe it is tied intrinsically, but there's nothing that says it is. And I don't know that I would agree that it is Bob rather than it is something that Coop's lineage has been dealing with, because it wasn't just his mother, but his grandfather, because that ring came from his grandfather that was given to his mother after his grandfather's death.
There's actually quite a bit I have about the ring, which actually I think gets introduced into like the subsequent years. But I guess to kind of keep it on Bob for a moment, though, I think of in season two, it is after once again after Leland's death, when Albert is actually the one who says maybe that's all Bob is, the evil that men do. And I think that Bob, he's one of many facets of it, but I think he's emblematic of it. And I think that, you know, we just see that through Leland with his actions towards Laura, or we see this with Mr. C, where honestly, technically we don't see a whole lot because there's that 25-year gap. We just kind of get a sense of what it is. But I think that Bob, even though he is I think he is emblematic of the evil that men do, I believe that there's some sort of hierarchy in the Black Lodge, and he's just like this, like almost a subservient that, you know, I could never fully articulate why, but Mike and the Arm, where they have a certain authority over him, hence giving up the Garmin Bosia. But I hope that sets a precedent for how I feel about Bob and then the visions going on this point onward. To kind of switch topics for a moment, Marie, she's actually discussed more again, where she has a newfound faith that Cooper's weary of. And I wrote down that it was potentially influenced by his father, because his father seemed to have a chip on his shoulder about organized religion and authority to some extent. Was there anything we should discuss about Cooper and this dynamic with Marie and his father?
I mean, thing with Marie, Coop's skepticism of organized religion stemming from his father is fine. With Marie and her newfound religion after the drug overdose and subsequent hospitalization and dealing, and she met this person that a poet that hung himself, and then she found Jesus and shaved her head and all that stuff. The fact that it stemmed from a place of her being in a vulnerable position, I think, is where this skepticism with the religion in his eyes comes from, because she was indoctrinated at a vulnerable point of her life, which does happen a lot of the time when it comes to the does happen a lot. But she found a solid foundation in putting in this religious aspect where she didn't have to deal with her internal turmoil more than she had to, because she had that religion to fall back to, which is something that I think Coop may, like, one, of course, had the skepticism towards, but he also does not have that foundation at this point. He has questions and no answers. I feel, as we see, is resentful of that. Not so much jealous, because he is not very much into the organized religion aspect. He doesn't buy into it, but he has no answers, and he doesn't feel that Marie has answers either, even though she seems to feel that she has answers.
Initially, when I first read this part, I kind of took it as initially as we were going through the day by day aspect, that it showed that how his father influences him, not in a bad or good way, just that he influences him. But I think what's interesting is that this is really the only year where I think we see cynicism really emerging from Cooper, because, you know, he has lunch with Anne in March of 1969. And he goes to what I wrote down as a dark place to even passively plan blowing up houses for Anne's affection. But he does settle for blowing up a girl's mailbox named Nancy, and thinks he did good. Later on that summer, and I know this is a bit of an odyssey for him, but when he's in Boy Scouts, he thinks of the rival scouts as Nazis, and that he never slept better as they endured food poisoning. And I don't think it's necessarily like a break of character. I think that when you're like 14 and you're gonna record all of your innermost thoughts, that stuff like this is gonna slip through. But I just thought it was interesting that it was around this era where we see the extra like jaded Cooper.
So I like to keep in mind that he is 14. He's like 15 at this point, I think, and going through those hormonal changes. We know he's been having a lot of hormone issues, but I also think that this ties back to his tendency to not want to follow through or resolve feelings rather than dissect them. He likes to solve feelings rather than feel feelings. So he's got these feelings about Anne, and he doesn't know what to deal with them, how to deal with them, because he wants to deal with them rather than feel them, which isn't necessarily a healthy way to approach feeling your feelings. So he resorts to violence, which is an expression of he's doing a certain type of coping mechanism for feelings. So having a release of emotion, i.e., blowing up a mailbox. So he built up these feelings, released the feelings, and has not resolved them. And that is what we see him do throughout, most of his younger years, is not feeling his feelings, but dealing with feelings, dissecting feelings, keeping them and analyzing them and wanting to solve them or master feelings rather than feeling them.
That's a great observation. I actually would say I agree on all of that, I would say. I guess I had like almost a maybe like too high expectations on grounds that the previous year that he was actually given the advice to the special agent. I was like, oh, maybe he's different from other teenagers. And like I said, it's the type of thing where if a 14-year-old boy recorded everything, I could see it. I just remember thinking for Cooper, I was like, oh, I'm surprised it's a little bit jaded. But, having said all that, even in the midst of all this, he does actually help a man with a severed hand. I thought it was interesting that rope that he feels injected with electricity and thinks this must be what FBI agents feel like. And I think this is really interesting because it's another step towards him wanting to be part of the FBI, but it's that part of injected with electricity because usually when I think of electricity, I think of more so the Lynchian aspect. And I never, at least up until rereading this, I never quite thought of it from like the Frost aspect. And I know Scott and Mark Frost, they're not the same person, but I've always associated electricity with Lynch in particular. So I thought all of this part was just extraordinarily interesting for Cooper.
So when I read that bit about the severed hand, I brought this back to occurrences within my own life where not to say that I've dealt with anybody with a severed hand, but people who have CPTSD or people who have had a series of traumas in their life where they've had to grow up far beyond their years can have a tendency to be able, and a lot of people call this be good under pressure, but it is an aspect of, CPTSD and PTSD where they. Way that like brain chemistry can kind of alter yourself internally, that he's able to deal with that. I see it as a reflection of the trauma he's already built up to this point, that he is, as a child, is able to compartmentalize emotion to the point of being able to snap into this, into helping. It's both a boon to his character and a reflection of he is already at a point in his life where he is beyond his years in what could be considered a maladaptive sort of way, because he does have this tool of being good under pressure, but he is a child and he shouldn't have to be. He like what brought him to this point that he is good under pressure in this aspect?
I think actually, strangely enough, because I know we went through a little bit about him at a Boy Scout camp, but I think a lot of this really ties into who he is when he takes upon himself to walk all the way home. And it's not just like it's like a few miles away. This is a long walk. I think it's like beyond state lines. But we do have his first time having coffee and cherry pie, his first ever experience with a combination of the two. But also, April was his foray to show like how he is when he's around women. And he says that he feels electricity when they make love under the pyramid. I think I should mention is that I think, isn't she with someone? Like she's already romantically with someone, but April and Cooper, they just make love. I think it's in the van, I'm pretty sure. I think that he hitchhikes with them.
Hold on. You're saying that Cooper and April made love? I thought it was him being outside while April and her partner made love, and he has a voyeur aspect.
Okay, I thought it was at least the way I wrote it down was that it says making love under the pyramid because April does give it to him and he glues it on his ceiling as like a memory of sorts.
They are making love. Okay. So, yeah, sorry, I went and found it. I'm sitting back under a small crystal pyramid glued to the ceiling, which, according to April, increases the electric field as they are making love. So, Star and April are the ones having this experience. He does not have sex. He almost does, but then he cuts his foot.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. No, you're right.
No, you're good. I had to go back and look at it, but I think with April, he found this connection because she was going through a very nomadic and hippie, I guess, like lifestyle. that kind of connected to the spiritualism that he kind of connects with. But April and Star kind of open up this spiritualistic thing that he's never really come in contact with as much. But I think that was a very important time for him because he honestly, like Laura, tends to seek out companionship when fighting off the aspects of what we would call Bob and the intrinsic loneliness. And we see this later in his life, but he tends to seek out female companionship, particularly when he is in a darker place to, as I said before, deal with emotion rather than feel the emotion.
Admittedly, I might have misconstrued because I know there's someone else later on in his life where it's like someone who's a similar personality to April. So I probably wrote down the wrong notes.
Andy,
Yes,
or what's her
Andy.
name?
Yeah, Andy, I think, is the one where he has the real actual sexual experience.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So I did jump the gun on that, I will admit. But before we close out in 1969, it actually ends with a very pivotal part where his mother has yet another Bob dream on November 1st of 1969, saying that he's almost through the door, only for her to die 2 weeks later. And it's around this point where Cooper isn't really recording all that much, and he's in a very dark place from this point on. I know that we discussed a bit about like the Bob dynamic, but is there anything we should keep in mind about the ramifications of his mother's death from this point on?
I would actually, because there's this one part before that's like right after his mother's death where he has that 3 months of not speaking, like, or like he says he hasn't talked in 3 months. And I really find that profound if he was to, like, not even that, like, is it an aspect of him not speaking to the recorder for 3 months, or did he just not talk for 3 months because he had no one to? Because he said he felt there was nothing to say.
I think you might be right because I thought that maybe him and his father were talking things out, but I don't think there's any implication that there's anything about his bond with his father during this time. So he might have actually been quiet to himself.
Yeah, so yeah, have not talked for a very long time. Didn't seem to be much point. The next thing he says is, you know, his mom's been gone for 3 months and his dad has hyper-focused on moon charts in order to avoid feeling feelings. So it makes me feel like neither of them, after scattering his mom's ashes, neither of them have addressed or their feelings or allowed themselves, like Dale is grieving and having no connection to anybody that is significant enough for him to be able to find solace. And he's not getting that from his father. So, unlike when his grandmother died, where his mom was there to support him and be like, death is a part of life and we need to, and you need to, you know, have that intrinsic connection, he does not have that emotional support with his father, even though they have a good relationship. They just don't have that kind of relationship.
I think one thing that reaffirms that feeling of isolation that he has is that April does become his teacher at some point early 1970, but she kind of has this like sharp cutoff point of like, let's not talk about last summer, or let's just kind of just pretend it didn't happen. And there's nothing that's really, at least I don't have listed till May 25th of 1970, where he has a dream where he sees his mother, and he wakes up to find a gold ring in his hand, the ring being from her father, and was not seen after she was married. I'm sure that Scott Frost was very conscious about it, but I feel like the ring that he gives up to the giant in season two and then retrieves it before Leland's death, I think it adds a lot of credence to just like how much he was sacrificing to give this to the giant.
Yes, especially since later on he has a dream and wakes up with it on, and he says, and that's where it will stay. And then we see him with that in the series. But I think that also speaks to a lot of his self-sacrificing nature. And we saw that also with his self-preservation issues, where he would be like, well, if I'm going to be a proper Boy Scout, I should know how to survive on my own. I'll walk home. So this nature where he is analytical and curious, and the sense of determination he has is well beyond a self-sacrificing point, to a point where he is giving up such things.
And from this point on, he has like a really scattershot summer because he has his first sexual experience with Marie on July 4th of 1970, which is actually kind of funny, but also kind of like nefarious with what's to come because the fireworks just kind of go a little too crazy. And he does refer to the fire as frightening even. During this time, because we were mentioning the Boy Scout part, he does become an Eagle Scout on July 12th of 1970. But I'm sure that celebration was more than short-lived because only 2 days later, Marie dies from drowning. And I think this is very pivotal from Cooper onward because he says that he feels like she could have been saved if he was there, and he feels this tremendous guilt. He found his mother's ring on his finger before leaving. And this is what closed out 1970 for me. And I cannot stress that Marie's death, how much it will not only haunt him, but I think it really fits in with his character. Well, from what we see in the original series and the return.
Yes, I feel that Coop takes on a lot because he has a very, like, I say a lot about his analytical nature and wanting to solve emotions rather than deal with emotions, but he has a great deal of empathy. And with the prophetic nature of a lot of his dreams, and as well as his mom, because his mom knew something was up before his grandmother was passing, he knew something was up, and there was a passage about it, how he would always know when something was going to happen. And then there was in the dossier how it was mentioned that Coop would constantly take care of his mom. The prophetic nature of his dreams, I think, would aid his guilt because even though it is an inevitability, he feels he could have done something about it, which ties with a lot of what happens with Laura and with the return and that ending where he is so riddled by this guilt of wanting to change the past that he cannot accept it.
That is exactly what I was going to get to. Because I mentioned this in my previous episodes whenever I mentioned that scene in part 17, is that for all of his like remarkable deduction techniques, for all of like his intuition, he doesn't quite get the larger introspection of why saving Laura is actually a bad thing. I don't know, and I would even doubt that Mark Frost and David Lynch had Marie in mind, but I think she fits in so perfectly for why he would feel so compelled that he has to save her, that he never quite understands why this is actually a detriment.
Yes, and it's not just Marie either. It's in his college years when he does find that girl because he lost that man after his intuition leads him to be like, this guy's up to something. And he follows him, but he loses him. And then he finds the body. And it aids a lot to this nature of him where he was like, I should have been just that little bit quicker, just that little bit better. If I had just been had been more skilled, if I'd been more like anything, this, that, it could have changed things. But not being able to reconcile that some things are and some things shall always be, and even though they are tragic, you can move on and can live. I don't think he's ever really made peace with that, ever.
I actually completely agree with that because we only get a few cryptic letters, not even recordings, just letters to his father from 1971 to 1973. When he comes back, he still thinks that good cannot overcome evil. So I think there is this defeatist attitude. But I think one thing I do want to focus on about his time away from his father and away from everyone is that it's actually mentioned in the original season two finale script. I can't confirm or deny if Mark Frost, Bob Engels, or Harley Payton had anything in mind for a tentative 1991 season three, but Windham Earle does say to Cooper in that script that I know what you did during those 3 years. Because for me, before I read that, I just accepted that Cooper was on a journey of emotional healing. This is where he got in touch with his intuition, his fascination with Tibet, Eastern religion at large, his deduction techniques. But upon revisiting how he says that good cannot overcome evil, combined with what Windham Earle said in that script, it does make me wonder if there's something supposed to be more, maybe even secretive for Cooper, what he was dealing with. But do you have any thoughts about that?
I do actually, because in his first recording back from that 3-year trip, he does say the whole universe is one bright pearl and there's no need to understand it. That while there is that cynicism of like, can good ever overcome evil? In the opening, I said he has this lightness of spirit. There is this optimistic skepticism where there is good in the world. And he does kind of have this moment of where in his teenage years, we were talking about how Marie had these answers or felt she had these answers that he did not buy into. He has come to the conclusion that he does not need answers and can live with that. Now, that doesn't solve any of his emotional issues, but it does solve the existentialism at the very least. But it does still, like, he has this cynicism, but he still has that brightness.
I think for me, when I think of the which one he skews more towards, I think of the scene in season two when Hawk is explaining the Black Lodge to Cooper, and he talks about if you face this with imperfect courage, it will annihilate your soul. While I would actually strongly agree that going in to rescue Annie from Wyndham Earle is like one of the best displays of courage that he could have given, I think that there is a susceptibility that he's had. And I'm saying this taking this book and Marie's death more so in active account. But I think that the idea that if he felt that good cannot overcome evil, that it never quite went away. That I know that imperfect courage can be, you could ask yourself, what is imperfect courage? But I couldn't help but thinking about those aspects of season two when I was like going through that that part in My Life, My Tapes again.
So when I look back to that imperfect courage and I look back at My Life, My Tapes, and I look and I'm looking at this means the scene in the lodge specifically, his courage did not falter until he faced himself. His courage did not falter when he faced Wyndham or when he faced Bob. It was when his very doppelganger showed up that he ran, because that was what Hawk had said, that you need to face yourself rather than run, and if you do, there is that imperfect courage. So it ties to that self-sacrificing nature again. He does not care about his own well-being at that point when he's there to save Annie, but Annie, Carolyn disappears, Bob disappears, Wyndham's gone, and then it's just him and this doppelganger, and he runs. And that where he faltered. Everything else was courage. That was the only moment which he faltered, and as soon as he started running, he was already lost.
I think one thing that might actually kind of change the scene up is that in the season two finale, it's when Wyndham Earle says, "No, I'll trade your soul for Annie's." And the thing is that he doesn't hesitate for a single second. But with all this in mind, that if he can't face himself, then there's something to be said there.
Yeah. And with this doppelganger, there's a lot to say about that, of what it means to be a doppelganger of oneself. Like, is it really the internal whatever he keeps down, the dark natures of things? Or it is all want, and we see that with Mr. C, and rather than need. But for Coop, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that he's never really felt his, or like he may have started to feel emotions at some point, but he'd always put his own well-being to a back burner when it came to the ultimate good, or the needs of the one are lesser than the needs of the many. And he learned that from a very young age when taking care of his mother and father. Because I would say that he did take care of his father, because he always had to be careful about his own father's mental well-being growing up, as well as his mother's. So he had to be that have this emotional repression in order to deal with that. And because of that, he's got this door he's never opened, not just to Bob, but for himself. And when coming face to face with that, he couldn't deal.
I feel like that's a thing that Cooper never quite gets over, especially, or at least if we're going with the, I'm not even saying the final scene of Part 18. I'm even talking about the end credits of Part 18, that he can just never understand that what he's doing is detrimental, and that that he, not that he can never have that imperfect courage, but I feel like he's so has such a tunnel vision outside of his extraordinary abilities to be able to see beyond this thing.
Yes, and I this is one of those times where I would say very jokingly, if you only had therapy. So, like, he did have therapy. We know that that is in My Life, My Tapes book when after Carolyn happens. but we know he never got over that. I think if he had had a significant counselor in order to be able to unpack everything that he's never unpacked, he may have been able to, if not gain that perfect courage rather than facing that with imperfect courage, he may have had at least the tools in order to try and face that, because he did not have those tools. Everything was packed up. He never unpacked anything. All he had were the coping mechanisms of reaching out for female comfort and to push himself to his drive of justice to feel his worth in society.
To kind of cycle back to 1973 in My Life, My Tapes, it almost seems like he has a predetermined outcome because when he reemerges back into society, he is wearing a suit with a mature demeanor, but he's still debating between the circus or the FBI. It would be one thing if he was debating and then had the suit, but I think that because he like had that suit, and the way the book, from what I recall, it's really more so that he was like wearing that every day, that he just decided that this is how he's going to present himself to the world for the rest of his life. And that's totally fine. Even though we're talking about the faults and foibles of Cooper, he does have his place in the FBI, but I guess the circus fits that quirky personality. But I just still think it's kind of weird that he would still debate that after having the suit and the mature demeanor.
I mean, I would say that coming back after 3 years with a suit on says a lot about it. I honestly saw that as a bit of a metaphor that he found a band-aid and he is using that band-aid. It's like the masks that we wear when it comes to day-to-day life. We have masks for everything. That's an intrinsic part of human nature. But he found a mask that he decided to keep on. He found his person suit and he was sticking to that after the 3 years of soul searching and whatever else may have happened. He found his suit in life. Even when he was debating the circus, it was because he was looking at his skill set of knife throwing. So he was looking at his skill set to see where he should go with his life, even though it was still already a destiny to go that down that road.
The next subsequent parts of 1973, it's a little scattershot, but I think it all ties together what we were talking about thus far, because after the death of Jim, there was a man that he knew very briefly. His supernatural
Death, quote
intention.
unquote.
Oh, yes. I guess that's worth mentioning, but I think that's just that it's the way it's described in the book is that the supernatural intuition kicks in around this time. And then it's in September of 73, his father gives him a tape recorder, which is once again leaning closer to what we see of Cooper, because it's not just like a portable with a plug, it's like a plugless one. And then he said that he thinks women studying philosophy are wild savages, which I thought was such a strange.
That one was a little out of pocket. I thought that was more out of character than the blowing up a mailbox.
Yeah, this is. I know I was talking about the blowing up a mailbox, but I really have no idea. Because we, you know, I know we mentioned before is that he has one of many love interests, but I don't think it's even that. I think it was just something he just kind of thought just by being like certain events. But I guess there's not much more I can say about that. But to kind of cycle back, what we were talking about previously is that he does encounter a dream of Marie, who is in distress on September 26th of 1973. And yeah, this will not be the last time we see of Marie. In fact, it'll actually get worse from here on out. He does finally lose his virginity to a married woman named Andy the following month, and he does say he has strong feelings for her for some time. Yeah, so I know as mentioned before is that I got April wrong, but yeah, it was actually Andy I was referring to. But to kind of shift into a more serious part, he finds a woman that's assaulted and murdered in November of 1973, and it very much upsets him. To compound it is that barely 2 weeks later, he has a vision of Marie mouthing stop in his bedroom. He feels that Marie is in serious trouble. They don't use terms like purgatory or hellish, but that's kind of what I got from it. But it sets him off with a 2-day fever. So there's a lot of intense traumatic stuff. Like you're saying before about like if someone needed a therapist, at this point he probably could and should go for one.
Yeah. I mean, let's see. What year was it? 1973? Mental health wasn't great then.
I mean, I guess in all fairness, there's a teacher slash professor that encourages him to focus on the living and balance mental exercises with physical, which I mean, I guess by the standards of 1973, that's actually pretty good advice. I would still contend that, I mean, the physical part he certainly has down pat, as we see in the second episode of season one. but there's definitely room for debate on how much he's really taking care of himself mentally. One thing that sets the precedent is that before we close out on 1973, he tries his experiment of 48 hours of no sleep. You just see this like consistent updates where I think this is the one that has the drawing with like the multiple circles under and
Yep.
around his eyes. I guess that does reaffirm what I was saying about the teacher that he was talking to, that while the teacher did encourage him to balance mental exercise with physical, I think Cooper got the wrong vibe from it. I think he got the completely wrong message. And don't get wrong, this and then his bladder control one, these are actually pretty funny moments, but I think it's also emblematic of like Cooper's mentality during the mid-70s.
Yes, and it does also tie back to having an analytical nature to his emotions and mental state rather than his emotional. The professor was definitely talking about emotional activity and balancing that with the physical, where he took that as mental and started the sleep analysis. But he had that relapse with Marie, and I would say relapse because it was similar to the fever that he had in right before his mom started going down that road of fighting to keep that door closed with the man. I would tie that together definitely, but he is tending to solve his problems more with dissecting and analyzing his emotional capacity and emotional, or trying to master emotion and mental faculties rather than expressing them and exploring them. And I think this is just another show of that nature to try and master himself rather than trying to learn himself, because I feel that his spiritual nature, he uses his spiritual nature to try and even out his emotional stance whenever he becomes too much. So he uses that as a way to master his emotion using this spiritual nature he's taken on in his exploration of Eastern mentalities and philosophies.
Now that we're going to go to 1974, I think that all this does tie into what he faces throughout the year. But I should mention is that in January, Andy, she does return and she gives him the Kama Sutra, but leaves back to go return to Holland a month later. And I think that everything we're talking about, combined with having the Kama Sutra, he goes through a terrible experience in New York City. He studies the criminally insane at a county hospital, a hostage situation. He's actually on a Nixon about Watergate before it actually breaks out. One of the key parts is that he has a hard time balancing acts of good with sexual desires. He ends up picking up an FBI brochure in late May of 1974. To come back to what we're saying about him and counting cards, he wins $2,000 at a casino, which he does give to his father as a wedding gift because his father just got remarried. He's lamenting the death of Marie during this time as well. Unfortunately, Cooper's father, his newfound wife Charlotte, leaves him very shortly after, before the year is out. And to make matters even worse, 9 months of tapes were destroyed in a fire ignited by an electrical blanket. I know that's quite the information dump, but it just seems like everything we're talking about Cooper just fits very perfectly what we're saying so far.
Yes, and tying it back to when Andy came back, she mentions that emotions were not a factor to their relationship, that it was a physical relationship only, and he expresses being confused about that. And he ties a lot of his emotional stability to whatever his partner is because he's seeking that comfort and that stability in a partner. He hasn't really had a caretaker. And it's not fair to say that it is not fair to say that he should be looking for a caretaker and a partner, but I believe that he is at least looking for an equal, and he has not been able to find that in any person so far, and he's been looking for that desperately.
Once again, once we're getting to 1975, there's going to be even more problems with definitely his mental stability, because he does start with a bladder endurance test, which again is very funny on ground level, but again, it shows that he's not really learning a whole lot. He does have celibacy problems with a woman named Joan throughout the whole summer. There's another woman named Lena who definitely is dealing with severe mental issues because there's a fire erupt that erupts when he go visits her parents after her
That's
mother
right, the
makes it past.
arsonist.
Lena and Dale, they spontaneously make love while they're in a car, and it leads to a crash through cattle. She, strange enough, has her first major orgasm, and an unhappy farmer comes in to witness all this. And then she still wants to make love in front of a fireplace not long after. Since we're mentioning the mental health, she is checked into a mental hospital at some point after. And it's around this time that I should mention is that Dell is actually trying to find religion and spirituality. So I think that that's not really a coincidence compared to everything that he's been dealing with in 1975 and also how he's been handling it.
Yeah, and it does set him off to look for answers. He's looking for answers to the existentialism he faces as he is gathering these relationships with very mentally unwell people and kind of not really addressing them. He's expressing this stuff happened to this person. They checked themselves into a mental hospital. They had intercourse in front of a fire, and yeah, the house, they set fire to the parents' house. But it never expresses him reaching out to his partner to ask about it, to try and it's just he's taking it at face value rather than saying, "Are you okay?"
I feel like he finds the worst type of help at the worst time. It probably seems like a good idea at the time, but on December 17th of 1975, he meets Wyndham Earle for the first time, and he views the opportunity of being in the FBI as a quote unquote rekindled fire. And this is actually where we cycle back to the very beginning of the book because he actually starts to reach out to the gang members who stole Bradley's bike early on, and he finds out that Ted, one of the three men, he was actually raped in prison. And it led to Dale being less presumptuous, but it ended up leading to an altercation with the second gang member, and he just didn't bother trying to find the third. After his hospital visit, he does reach out to Wyndham Earle in December 28th of 1975. So I think he's trying his best. Because of course we have no, he has, why would he have knowledge of Wyndham Earle and his psychotic behavior at this point? It seems like it would be the perv, he probably, I guess the best way I could say is that we've always seen Kenneth Welsh portray Wyndham Earle in a very unhinged manner, but I'll be curious of like how he would have handled Wyndham Earle if he was able to have scenes before these events, because Kenneth Welsh comes off as a very extraordinarily charming gentleman, and I think that you could have maybe coerced isn't really the right word. I don't think that was really, I wouldn't rule it out, but I don't think that Wyndham Earle was actively trying to coerce Dale into the FBI. But I would see that once Wyndham Earle had Cooper in the FBI, that that's when the coercion would slowly seep in.
I think that he definitely saw potential in Coop. And to some extent, Wyndham has a kind of intuition about him. You could see that in Coop. But I don't know about coercion so much as the spark that started something. It was a spark. And then later on, he's like, yes, this is what I shall take on. In the books, he's the charming Hannibal Lecter, and in the movie, he's the unhinged Hannibal Lecter of the series. So it's interesting to see that point of view in these books where he is a charming, rational, highly intelligent, and sophisticated man versus what we see in the show, which was a man cracking.
I think what makes it hard to kind of decode Wyndham Earle in this regard is that he is indeed cracking the events of season two, but always seems like he has a leg up on Cooper during the whole time. And while I'm critical of the writing of Wyndham Earle once we reach the end of season two, that there is something about how he always like could always well, first and foremost, Cooper could never beat him a single game of chess. So now that there's lives at stake, that's a factor of like not even trying to beat him, just have a stalemate because he is that much of a rival to Cooper. So we're looking at him through what we see in season two as it's like someone who's unhinged, very Cesar Romero Joker. But it's when you think of in this point in my life, my tapes, he at least presents himself in a very cordial manner.
Yeah, at this point it was assumed he had already he, that he was already a sophisticated serial killer. Or at least that's what I saw from the dossier, that he had at this point already had this nature that he was hiding.
Yeah, I would agree with that, where it's because we were talking about the unhinged nature in season two for Wooden Emerald. We'll get to it when we get to the later part of the 70s in My Life, My Tapes, but it does show the insinuation that he was always that half key turn away from being that person. It's just that leading up to it, he was very good at hiding it. But to go on to 1976, though, it is a little bit removed from the way we're talking about, but there's very little to go by for 1976 because his father goes bankrupt and decides to sell his home. And upon returning home, Dell has J. Edgar letter, his Ephraim Zimbalist autograph, and a photo of Marie. And he does finish college. He's not sure what to do because he's still too young for the FBI. But yeah, once we do get to 1977, he does well with his entry to the FBI and throughout most of the training. His father is on the rebound. Emmett, he's actually reached out to Cooper at this point, and he actually despises Cooper's decision because Emmett has such problems with authority. There is one caveat, though, that Cooper does have, because while he does well for Moses' FBI training, his simulation raid is failed because he has attraction to a woman named Robin. And at that point, he wishes to never let his guard down. So we're kind of piggybacking off what we were talking about before about why with Marie, if she was like a part where he doesn't have that introspection of like the bigger picture, Robin to me is like the equivalent of him not understanding the bigger picture, but through the lens of his profession.
Yeah, and he does, like, in the show, he does say that he's looking at the bigger picture overall a lot of the time. But it is through his own lens. So I would agree with that.
Since he did fail this raid, he does become a special agent on December 11th of 1976 as a salutatorian. I'm pretty sure Robin, she was the valedictorian because it seemed like those two worked very well alongside each other. And his father gives him yet another new recorder as a gift. He does say goodbye to Robin and he does move to PA or Pennsylvania, specifically, I would imagine Philadelphia in within that week. And we get a very prominent character who he meets upon going to Philadelphia, who is, of course, Diane on December 19th of 1977, and refers to her as a saint and a cabaret singer. From 1970 onward, we're going to just go deep into his time in the FBI and a lot of the trauma he's going to deal with. But anything we should keep in mind about his very early days of being the FBI?
I would say, actually, not much. I did like his academic rivalry with Robin. And did that not turn into slightly romantic or sexual at one point?
I'm pretty sure she does come back at a certain point, but his feelings are very strong with her, I think, throughout his whole duration. I think that's why he feels so hard on himself because of the failed raid. And like I said, this is one of many women that come and go. And I know I mentioned before is that when you record your every thought to one degree or another from for 22 years, a lot's going to come out. But I feel like even the realm of with that mindset, he goes through a lot of women where they kind of show up for a little bit and then he moves on to the next one. And something that he clearly is not good at once you get to the original series, even the return for that matter.
He puts a lot of emotional stock into the women that he meets and then is dumbfounded when they move on. I think that a lot of the time he's taking these women and putting them on a pedestal rather than meeting them as a partner because he is so desperate to look for that equal that he's just like, you're the one. You're the one. Please be the one.
I will say though, he does seem like he has some degree of boundaries where you can kind of see where he's coming from. Like, for example, in the original series, of course, Audrey is just head over heels for him. And while he does not hesitate to rescue her, when it does reach the point where it could get romantic, he says, "You are a high school girl." But then also, I think of how he moves on to Annie Blackburn, where I never got the sense he would tell Audrey, he'd tell Annie about Audrey. But I'm thinking of that scene with John Justice Wheeler and Cooper. Where John Justice Wheeler, he's very down and out about his feelings about how things are going with him and Audrey. But Cooper's talking about love. It's like you'll know it when you feel it, and it's like no other feeling. And the thing is that Annie does not end well either. So even the realm of just the original series, not never mind My Life, My Tapes, I think it shows like how he feels in that moment, how he feels like this is the one, but always seems to find another one.
Yes, and with Audrey, I think I honestly do like how that was handled, where he's been with a lot of people at this point that have been very, very vulnerable, and he has not taken that into account when he has started a relationship. And with Audrey, he has this principle of no, you are a high school student and you are obviously not well right now, and you need a friend more than anything. I think that has a lot to do with what he needed at that age. He needed a person to talk to and a friend rather than a sexual partner that he needed to invest with, that he can invest short-term emotion into rather than a long-term benefit. And Annie aside, I think a lot of that with Annie, it was that Annie had been at her lowest moment already and was recovered or recovering at the very least, so that he didn't have to be the person to support rather than being able to support each other because they've both already been at their lowest points.
I think this is all really good buildup because, of course, we'll get a little bit further with Diane as we go along. But I have always viewed that when it comes to Cooper, if he had one love interest, it would have been Diane. But in my opinion, he still screws it up tremendously because, from this point on, I'm not just talking about for the rest of the book. I'm just talking about from, well, I mean, I guess it goes from this point in the book until late in season two, but Cooper is very upfront about his personal and emotional feelings with Diane. Like, he can be very vulnerable with her. And granted, it's a very, I wouldn't even say transactional, but it's definitely one way because he's recording it and then sending it to her. But we get to the return, and I'm thinking of Part 18, where Diane, he says to her before they cross after the 430 miles, like, it could all be different. I know that there's circumstances that can be discussed and theorized, but you think of like the sexual interaction they have in Part 18. It's like the most uncomfortable, cold, honestly horrific scene. And she's very clearly not enjoying it. He's very bizarrely cold. And put aside anything about theorizing, but I feel like if Diane is quote unquote the one that he could be vulnerable to, he was not really the right one to be. He was not handling it properly, I would say.
No, I think when it came to Diane, it was an odd mix of too much professional respect because he's always very vulnerable, but it was always in a very like how he would be with honestly anybody else, that he would be like, yes, this is how I am right now. As it, like, even like, not doing okay, I'm grumpy and a little tired. Just how you talk to someone because there is no response. There is no response back from Diane. We don't get to hear that. We don't get to see that. He's put all this investment into someone who didn't have a face for us for years. And I don't know if that says anything, or it may or may not, but it is kind of like, who's the woman in Powerpuff Girls that had her face cut off the entire time? The assistant to the mayor? There's no face to this person.
It's very telling that before Laura Dern was confirmed to be Diane, that there was a theorization that Diane was the tape recorder. Because actually, it was on my Diane episode where Sally, she brought up the great point that these tapes, they're not really shipped off instantly. And of course, like in the case of with Diane in season one, when he thinks he has the tasteless gumdrop, only find it was his earplug, it's sent the next day. And there's a lot of factors of how that doesn't quite factor because international shipping was probably not really a thing in 1989. But to cycle back, is that there's something about the Diane character where she was very deliberately faceless. And also just the fact that if people thought she was a recorder and that was like a thing that gained traction, it's very telling of the dynamic that Cooper does have with Diane.
Yeah, that faceless nature, I think, has a lot to do with his ability to be vulnerable. As far as like the tape recordings were and what we see in the books, but anytime he's addressing Diane, I always get this sense of intense pedestal-like respect, where even Diane, even though he is the most vulnerable with her, there's so much awe and respect for her at what she does and how she does it and who she is, that it is a kind of unattainability that makes it like, ah, this is so much easier because you are not someone I can pursue.
To kind of introduce the other prominent characters is that in 1978, Cooper will meet Albert for the first time in February, and then he'll formally meet Wyndham Earle in April. But also during this time, because it's his early days in the FBI, he gets his first case very early in the year. And this is where he'll start saying Diane at the beginning of every tape. You know, it's like we were just talking about like the relationship that they have. But I think that that all will be reaffirmed one way or another throughout the rest of this book. He does feel hollow about his successful first case. It was a very hollow victory for him. But also, one thing is that he takes his first life on May 1st of 1978. And I'm pretty sure that Diane sends him flowers around this time just to console him. The rest of 1978 is going to be very emotionally packed, but is there anything we should keep in mind about his interactions with Albert or Wyndham Earle at this point?
I mean, when it comes to Albert, it's with a fond familiarity that I see the like, why is he so angry? But it speaks a lot to what will build, the friendship that will build. And with Wyndham Earle, I would say that it is the spark of much to learn in a kind of pupil-esque way that he takes Dale on, that Dale also is like, yes, this is my role as your pupil, as to learn from you, because you are obviously this great teacher and leader that I can aspire to be. That I think says a lot about the dynamic that they will build.
And I think that the reason why I wanted to really preface this is because there is a tremendous dysfunction between Caroline and Wyndham, or even with Cooper. I think that even with him, even with his feelings for Caroline, that he should have actually been a little more on top of it because he meets her on May 2nd and is entranced by her. He even has a dream, once again referring to the electricity, is that he refers it he references electrodes. But Wyndham Earle goes missing on the 1st of August, and this is where Cooper's attraction starts to kick in for Caroline. And it seems like he stays missing for some time. And but early on it, he Cooper does meet Goran Cole, and it seems like it's a pleasant, like what you would expect from Goran Cole, but they don't really go too much further into it. But like while Wyndham is missing, once again, something else that Cooper probably should have been more on about is that two members of organized crime are found dead with black and white squares in Wyndham's absence. You know, I guess when you work alongside with someone for a better part of a year, and it's why I was questioning before about how Wyndham was when he was quote unquote normal, is that maybe he just felt so had such like a strong relationship with Wyndham that's like, oh, it couldn't be him.
I mean, to make a little joke, Hannibal Lecter, no one suspected him, but he would make tiny jokes about cannibalism all the time. So it is kind of like the mask is so well made, no one can see past it. Even this man who has such great intuition, honestly, with most people. So it is saying, like, it is telling, like you said.
In 1979, he has another strange interaction because Cooper does go on vacation and he actually finds the old man that taught Wyndham chess. The old man says he sees death in Cooper's face and he actually, quote unquote, hangs himself not long after. And of course, this happens to be not long after that. Cooper falls under influence of a narcotic. It's the same time that Caroline goes missing. And Cooper, he thinks there's a mole and he feels compelled to tell Wyndham. Wyndham, he agrees to undergo hypnosis to help. And actually, I feel like that scene, I know I was being critical of Cooper and his relationship with Wyndham, but I guess I could see that with Cooper, if Wyndham would agree to undergo hypnosis, I could see why Cooper would think like, oh, it couldn't have possibly been this guy. It's almost like a Ted Bundy sort of thing, where when Ted Bundy was first questioned, they're like, this couldn't have been the guy, where he was instantly dismissed at first.
Yes, and I would also tie this back to what was written about Wyndham in the dossier, that Wyndham orchestrated a lot of the meetings with Carolyn and did have this kind of chess where Coop was already a pawn at this point. So Coop not seeing that, I would forgive, because it is the closest people, or it is said at least that it is the closest people that have the harshest betrayals. So Coop's already got this kinship with Wyndham that he's had because he's met Wyndham before, and he sees them as this kind of mysterious teacher for him. Though I would have hoped that Coop would have a little bit more. Well, Coop does have his hesitancy with Wyndham after that event with the old man and the time that he has on the island and the narcotic that he faces, because he is saying like things aren't adding up. I'm missing something.
The one thing that's worth mentioning is that during this time, Caroline is still missing. But Alita's found on April 10th of 1979 in Lower Manhattan, where they just missed her by a day. But then also, I think they pick up on that she's suffering from heroin addiction. And then she regains self-control once they do find her on April 13th of 1979. And it was an unidentified drug found in Caroline's IV bag that Cooper was the first one to find out. Also, the hypnosis that I was mentioned earlier revealed that one of the kidnappers was decapitated and his head was placed in Caroline's lap. And Cooper, to kind of conclude this aspect of Caroline's disappearance, that thinks she's repressing the main identity. Obviously, anyone who's read this book knows that this is all Wyndham Earle's being. It's like what I was saying before, is that he came off very charming, but he was always that half key turn away. And I mean, obviously for Caroline, this is like a beyond traumatic event. But you know, with Cooper, like he doesn't have a relationship with his brother. His father, I think it's more so his father just kind of wants to be to himself after basically losing the house. He doesn't really have anyone. So like it's his feelings with Caroline, he wants to be there for her. He's conflicted. But also, it's like we were saying before, is that with Wyndham, is that he doesn't want to believe it. Because it's just so unfathomable that someone like that would do that.
And he has found this kinship with Wyndham to a certain degree, where he has an emotional investment that he isn't willing to see the bad in the people he's closest with a lot of the time, because he does hold them in such high regard. And with Carolyn, one of the first things he says, I think, is like how strong of a character she is, that she has strength, and that I think with Wyndham, once he found himself a pupil to kind of play with, it sparked a domino effect of him taking care of this strong character and systematically breaking her down to see how far he could get her to go with Cooper there to be able to stabilize her here and there. A systematic, like a experiment on the human psyche and how far he could take her.
Actually, I know that we're about to get into the worst parts of Caroline and what Cooper deals with, but I think it's also a good time to mention that I think it's around this point we're reaching the soft starting point where things are not making sense in terms of continuity from Twin Peaks, because I forget the exact year, but when Cooper in season two, when he first starts talking about his love for Carolyn, and also when Coop or when Wyndham Earle killed her. I'm pretty sure he said it was like some point, it was like 7 years ago. It was definitely some point in the early mid 80s, but this is clearly late 70s. Now, I have a few thoughts on why we get subsequent inconsistencies from this point onward, but do you have any thoughts about it? Or was it just something that you just kind of just accepted and thought we can work around it?
Considering the things that I've accepted and worked around in other stories and other movies, shows, books, etc., I was just like, eh, people make mistakes. People find these inconsistencies, or people say this makes more sense with the context of the show that we've built so far. So it could just have been, yes, he said that, but it makes more sense for this to happen sequentially in this way, and we can't have all that happen at once.
For me, I know that, for people who probably, read this in 1991, that these are just blatant continuity errors. I don't even get on the Teresa Banks murder yet, but because this was actually, I read this book way later than the others, but I look at, say, like the Secret History and the Final Dossier, and actually I'll even lump in the Access Guide, is that it's almost like a game of telephone and we're just kind of going off of misinformation. The Secret Diary, we have the pages that are torn out, and also Laura dealing with like unfathomable trauma and just her suppressing who Leland truly is. But in the case of My Life, My Tapes, I look at it as basically the Diane Tulpa that we see from the early 90s, as described by Laura Dern in part 16, is that like she actually went back in, because these aren't actually recordings, they're just transcripts they were going through. So I kind of just took it as if she's like doctoring these transcripts. I couldn't really speculate why, but it's at the behest of Mr. C to, I don't know, potentially throw off anything for Gordon Cole or Albert in the event they try to go looking for Cooper. So for me, from this point onward, for specifically when Cooper starts his days in the FBI, that things are unreliable, and it's also just throw in a lot of half-truths and also throw us off. And like I said, that's all completely retrospective and definitely not the intent of Scott Frost at the time.
Yeah, I honestly also take it as when Coop is mentioning his timeline with Carolyn in the show, I excused it because that was also a time in which major trauma happened and he had to repress a lot himself, which when you do that, it can cause a lot of memory issues. So he could have just been lumping time together, considering it was so close to the 80s.
That's actually something I was actually firmly subscribing to back in back before I read My Life, My Tapes, because I knew that 1979 did not correlate with the year that he gave to Truman season two when he talked about Caroline and Winda Merle. And I was like, oh, you know, it's totally in the realm of possibility that Cooper misspoke because of this incident. I think there's other parts that can kind of correlate with the real life events, for lack of a better term, but it's really just this and the Teresa Banks murder, where it's just like there's just so much that's completely off that now that we have the return, there's that retrospect of like what makes sense or what clicks.
True. There is a lot of layers to the doctoring of Coop's life that Talpa-Dayan and Mr. C conducted very systematically in order to create the environment that Mr. C wanted for, or well, yeah, wanted for himself to be able to thrive.
With all that context in mind, it is worth mentioning is that Wyndham, I think this is sort of a he's shown his cards to Cooper because he know he has the upper hand, where he says that Wyndham says that he believes evil conquers good because of guile. And it's not long after this time that Caroline, she professes her love to Cooper on tape. And then on May 1st of 1979, Cooper is stabbed and Caroline is found dead. He finds out it was Wyndham like 2 weeks later. I guess for a brief later note, Cooper's father does come into the picture at this time and meets Goran Cole, and they actually get along really well. So I do like that Goran Cole, he does provide that levity, even if he's not explicitly in My Life, My Tapes. But to come back to the more intense stuff, Cooper believes he lost love and that he knows it. He actually starts blaming himself. He believes he set off the actions. He set off Wyndham Earle to lead to this. And actually, it was around this time where Cooper, he is clinically dead for 2 minutes on May 25th due to a hemorrhage and is actually spiritually broken for months after. And that's actually the last time we hear of Cooper in 1979.
Yeah, I wish he took care. Me talking about a character as if he's real, but I wish Coop took better care of himself. I like a lot of the time, and we see that in the show how he gets a gunshot and then it's just like, just check it out, patch it up, and I'm gonna keep going. And I feel that it has a lot to do with his sense of self-worth because of this guilt that he holds for Carolyn and Marie and even Wyndham. He blames himself for Wyndham's actions. And to a certain level, I believe Wyndham wanted to orchestrate that. I feel like he's trying to build Coop up. I'm not sure of where they were going to go before, you know, season two started, like season two, they were going to wrap things up. But I feel that if things had gone a little differently, Wyndham's motivations for Coop were a lot more pupil in nature, more than just FBI, but in the realm of good and evil, and in the realm of the search for truth, and whatever it was, the principles that Wyndham found and were trying to impart, that he did see a pawn and a potential equal in Coop, but it wasn't there yet, and he had just started with this tragedy that he orchestrated with Carolyn. And the guilt that he built in Coop, I believe, was intentional because he already saw this foundation for guilt and low self-worth in Coop already.
One thing that kind of kind of contrasts with it is that I believe it's in the first season. It's when Audrey, she's once again very much head over heels for Cooper. She says, "There's only one problem with you. You're too perfect." I couldn't say for sure which writer would agree or disagree, but I would say that Cooper, he has this almost like micro expression of like, "You don't quite understand me quite yet." I always thought that once we got to Caroline and his story about her in season two, that he tells Truman that this is a thing that's been actively on his mind because he pulls out a picture of Caroline in from his wallet. So this is something that hangs with him every day, despite the fact that he has this like quirky, upbeat energy, that there's this little thing that he's reminded of every day. So when Audrey says that, that's what my mind goes to.
Yeah, that was a devastating expression. It was just because he did see a sort of kinship in Audrey where there was a friendship that was building. And then I think that was a kind of breaking point where it's like, ah, yes, we may be friends, but you don't know me.
I know we mentioned that his recordings in 1979 stop like pretty much like right before June. And he actually does return to active status in February of 1980 and does come to terms with like what Wyndham did. It even confronts Wyndham about his crimes and also the old man that we mentioned like later that month. We kind of shift away from it for a while. Cooper goes to San Francisco with his father. He actually leaves him in Reno, and his father marries a woman named Shamrock. Speaking of unexpected women in their lives, he meets Robin again at this point. He's the one that wants to keep it in the past. Also, he works on a case where he's pretending to be a young male prostitute. And actually, this is where things start to get humorous again, where it's like it's not just about what Cooper's dealing with, but rather it's like a humorous case because once he does pose as a young male prostitute, he talks about how he actually really likes the how his leather feels on this on his skin. Which, by the way, with all the Cooper Truman shipping romance, like erotic fan fiction, there has to be at least one out there that's at least honed in on this and just leaned into it.
From experience with fan fiction, I can tell you there's probably more than one.
Oh, I would imagine so. But yeah, look, we're about to dive into yet another time jump because after Cooper does confront this killer, he does switch to the counterintelligence task force for 6 years. He writes to his father about Shamrock's foot incident in 1983, but then that's it. That's pretty much all we get about Cooper until I believe it's mid-late 1987. Should we actually, before we get into anything with his working with the DEA, that we should talk about during this like long time jump because we're going from effectively 1980 to just straight up 1987. And for that matter, he's actually not in the FBI that much. For you know, for a character that we think of as so affiliated with the FBI, he's not really in it that much once you take this book into context.
No, I mean, like, it is nice to actually see the multitudes of a person because while he is like, he's the FBI man, he's more than that. To a certain degree, doesn't even respect the FBI's authority because his intrinsic nature of goodness supersedes that. He's just, I'm not going to tell anybody anything about what happened here, there, or whatever happened because they're going to have to do stuff and I don't agree with it. That happened a lot in the series itself, but I also feel that his relationship with his father, I think, has is kind of like sad that they coexist, and it is someone that he grew up with, but not someone he's very emotionally invested in that much. It's just like, okay, well, have fun in with your life. It's this distance that's grown between his family, and it is showing a little bit more of the isolation that he's built.
I would agree that the distance, while the parts with his father show up are pretty funny, that this isn't quite the relationship he had in the 60s. So we pick up with Cooper in 1987, where he's working alongside with the DEA. And also, this is where he first teams up with Dennis Bryson on September 2nd of 1987, who, of course, you know, would transition to Denise later on. And of course, that would be a whole thing in season two with how Cooper accepts her and how Hawk or the other characters at that point how they approach it. But for the time and moving back to 1987 is that they arrived in Mexico and they're followed, I believe it's by a cartel, and Dennis is kidnapped. And Dennis also told Cooper about the suitcase that had weapons, which actually results in a like somewhat comedic approach where Cooper does rescue Dennis, but it's through a misstep of a grenade. Also, I believe that this cartel that we're mentioning, that they were either likely deported or at least know that's tangible. Is there anything about Cooper working with the DEA or Dennis or, you know, as we were mentioning, you know, later on Denise, we should think about?
The only thing that I would really pull from this is Coop's weird luck. With the way that things happen around Coop is that misfortune always falls, but in a way that he always makes out okay. And I would say that with the plane incident that we have in the recording, the tape recordings, where his plane almost crashes, but he makes out okay, where this misstep with a grenade happens, but then Dennis and he make out okay, and that things are weird. They fall into a weird Rube Goldberg machine of orchestrating this bad luck that ends up, he still ends up coming out on top. So that's the only thing where it's like, oh, that's another instance of this weird luck, this weird fate. Fated, it's almost like Final Destination-esque things that happen around him.
I'm glad that we got to have these two together because when you see Cooper and Denise in season two, they clearly have a history. And the thing is that, yeah, like, well, David Duchovny is one, it's just perfect in that role. But it's just that there's just a way that David Duchovny portrayed Denise. And it's just like, you just know that, like, with her previous past, that Denise was just like this, like, not just David Duchovny's performance, but just this ball of charisma that just permeates
Oh,
like
yeah.
her whole career in the DEA and why she gets the position she is in the return.
Denise is very obviously hyper competent at whatever she does, and she had to be because of who she is as a person and what she had to go through when after she understood who she really was. Even when she was then Dennis, Coop obviously got a lot, they obviously got along together. And she was charismatic the whole time. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they built up a solid friendship in the time that they spent.
I kind of wish that there was a little more with Dennis, like throughout, like up until My Life, My Tapes, just because they have such a like, storied history together. And I do really like this part, but just that, like, I always like the idea that there'd be more of a crossover with the two of them, like throughout the mid late 80s. But to kind of shift to another potentially out of character moment for Cooper is that he hasn't seen a dentist in 17 years, and he fears specifically the electric drill. He finds he has six cavities and asks Diane if there's regulations on shooting Dennis, but ultimately concedes that he did fine work after arrest, probably. This was another one that is a callback to the season two finale as written by Bob Engels, Mark Frost, and Harley Payton. I'm really glad this didn't make it into the final episode, but there was supposed to be that part where Cooper was going to be tied down to a dentist chair and that Bob would be a dentist. I think that Bob, Frank Silva, better yet, should never step out of that denim jacket because to me, that's Bob. I think that like having that one wardrobe just kind of there's just something that just sets off like a very unnerving, disconcerting nature. I think the dentist part is a little too over the top for my liking.
Someone in the writer's room feared dentists and enough to try and push this. And I think having this in the book here does bring back that fears don't have to be existential, that they can be fear of the dentist. I mean, if we're going to break it down, I would say that Coop's fear of the dentist is a fear to lose power over himself, to fear the loss of autonomy, because the dentist is, it's a very vulnerable place to be, to expose oneself, one's mouth. It's a very vulnerable place. And with the dentist, you could be put under and laughing gas, etc. And I don't necessarily think for Coop it would be a fear of the pain, but a fear of the loss of power and autonomy he would have at the hand of another person he does not know and or trust, if we're going to dissect it.
I kind of took it as Scott Frost kind of interjecting his feelings on going to the dentist. But if we had to go with Cooper, I'm thinking of like all the donuts, cherry pie, coffee that we see certainly in Twin Peaks. But the way he talks about when he, you know, as he gets to Twin Peaks, because he even talks about when he goes to Lamplighter End where he had a cherry pie, where this is just the thing he has all the time. So I think there's that like the ramifications of eating this stuff all the time. While Cooper maintains a great physique, that it still affects him in some way. So mine is just more so just like a humorous interpretation, admittedly.
We do know he is very meticulous with his grooming.
Now that we've settled everything with the dentist, he does fully return to the FBI on December 15th of 1987 and is glad to be back. However, a few weeks later, he does receive an insidious poem from Wyndham Earle to kind of go into further into this. Is that barely like a week and a half later? This is where Cooper, not Desmond, but Cooper investigates the Teresa Banks murder. Sheriff Cable's actually there, although he does feel like it's a different characterization from what we see in Gary Bullock in the movie. Also, Teresa did not live in a cabin or work at the Cross River Cafe in From Fire Walk With Me. So once again, this is like not just inconsistencies with Cooper, but like locales. And I guess the broad strokes are the same, but I think it is worth addressing. But Cooper discovers Teresa Mary Banks was born on July 11th of 1970 to Ellen and Tony Banks. Both were killed in a car accident when she was 12. She ran away from a state faculty at 15 and disappeared. She was unfortunately buried in an unmarked grave with only a pastor, county representatives, two grave diggers, and Cooper. At least at the time in early 1988, the case was still active. And also, Cooper, even like a couple weeks later, was still haunted by the death of Teresa Banks, one of which was set off by a dream with him, with the dancing man from another place, and presumably Laura Palmer. So, yes, once again, this is another big exposition dump, but I knew I had to go through it all in one go rather than just like go through point by point. But we were saying before about the inconsistencies with Caroline and Wyndham, but what are your thoughts on all of this pertain to Cooper's relationship with Teresa?
I think that these moments put more stock into your theory that Diane may have doctored the transcript. One, if we want to say it wasn't the tulpa, I would say that it would be Diane trying to protect Coop, because a lot of what happened in the Teresa Banks case in the movie was Coop following an odd intuition he could not explain with a rational or scientific thought. And it also covers up everything that happened with Jeffries and the disappearances of the FBI agent. So it does protect the secrecy of the Blue Rose case that was. If it wasn't Tulpa Diane, it could have been actual Diane protecting Coop.
That's not a bad observation because I, strange enough, out of all the things from Firewalk Me that I fixated on, it was actually more so Agent Desmond, but more specifically the ring that he gets under the trailer. Because I think of how important the ring is to Mr. C in The Return. Because you know we have obviously Teresa Banks had the ring, and then Desmond had the ring. He disappeared. There's the nurse at the end of the missing pieces, but we get the Dougie Tulpa. He's wearing the ring in The Return. But it's just, for me, it's hard to believe that Mr. C was not a factor to that. And that at some point in that 25 years, there's a lot about the ring that I don't know if I could really talk about offhand, but at some point that Diane had to be a factor in like being at least tangentially related with the ring and kind of keeping it from Gordon Cole and Albert and anything that would lead them back to Cooper in any capacity.
I mean, the ring itself disappears and reappears on its own. It doesn't necessarily need Diane to interfere. We see that happen. My curiosity is with Coop's ring and the Teresa Banks ring, that with everything like that, it is the same, like the same mark. So I'm wondering if there is a different correlation between that one and the one that's on Coop's finger as Dougie, and whether or not it is just a factor of being connected to the lodge or being connected to Bob. Because everything that the lodge is not Bob. He is of the lodge.
That's actually a really great point because I always thought of, at least with Cooper's relationship with the ring in season two, that it was more so with the giant. And I've kind of gone back and forth, but I always thought there was something more pertaining to the White Lodge when it came to that. Also, just because there's the ring could be like a golden circle, and it makes me think of like, at least indirectly, the golden orb we see with Laura Palmer. Because there is that little golden orb when the giant, I think it's like when he disappears when he sees Cooper in bed in season two. Again, I know these are all very vague and I can't properly articulate it, but when I think of the gold ring, I'm thinking more so just like strictly with the giant rather than like how it fits in with the larger framework.
I mean, we're looking at this ring and how it fits with the giant, and that this has been on Coop's finger for over a decade at this point, and at the same time has not left, as he has said. But at the same time, a very similar ring is on Teresa Banks's finger, has been with the agents, has been in Laura Palmer's hands toward the end of Fire Walk With Me. And whatever the ring is that it does for its wearer, I would say is tied to the lodge rather than to Bob. And saying like White Lodge or Black Lodge, I'm not sure there is a difference between the two, considering how tied they are. I think it just may be that there are aspects of this lodge that are good and evil, but power. It is a power in of itself, and the The giant still has power within the lodge in order to within the White Lodge itself to impose this knowledge for Coop and try to help him. But we see that the influences that we see with the giant are so similar to what we see with the Black Lodge with the arm, and I would say that it's two rooms of the same house, you know?
When I think of the giant, and we'll shift back to My Life, My Tapes after this, but when I think of the giant, I think of like he's referred to as the giant only by Cooper in the original series, and that's his name that he gave him. But in the return, he says to Andy, "I am the fireman," and it seems like he's in primarily in the White Lodge at that point. So I kind of thought that it's almost like a low key way of goods overcoming evil where. He is a part of the White Lodge. He's a very center point of Part Eight in terms of Laura Palmer and the Golden Orb. Also, I think that the idea that if he can get Cooper to the White Lodge, and also that means that the Giant, as we see in Season Two, that he might be, I don't know if he's visiting the Black Lodge or if it's even actually the Giant that we see. I guess it depends on how we view the one in the same line that's delivered by Karell Struckin in the Season Two finale. But like I said, the Giant slash Fireman is such an amorphous character. I don't know if I'm quite ready for this episode just yet, but I just want to at least give my cursory opinions on it.
No, I completely understand. The way that the White Lodge is presented is so, like, it's all black and white. There's a lot to it and a lot of symbolism to it that I would say is so similar to the concepts of the Black Lodge and the White Lodge that it's just two forces working in the same space. But that is a lot to unpack. And the fireman is this whole thing. And even with the White Lodge being what it is, there's still a darkness to it that seems so tangential to the Black Lodge that it's hard to distinguish the two.
To come back to My Life, My Tapes, though, Wyndham, he does attempt to escape and he sends another tape to Cooper. Dal is actually rattled by this because he befriended two patients who were almost finished with their time there before Wyndham killed them. On an unrelated note, we were talking about Diane earlier, but on June 10th of 1988, he asks if Diane will go to dinner with him. And all I can think of is that there's that intro with Diane where I don't know how I missed it on the first time, but the second time, it's like the most double entendre about talking about the Peking duck that she had and how the skin stretched and how it was delicious. Yeah, I know we talked a lot about Diane and the dynamic that Cooper has with her, but apparently, according to David Lynch, when he was filming The Return, he told Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern that Goran Cole, but not Albert, knew that there was a romance between Cooper and Diane. Is there anything we should keep in mind with what David Lynch said or what we see in this book that should be discussed?
I mean, in June of 88 is when we have this very cryptic message, but I find it kind of odd that immediately afterward he asks Diane to dinner when Wyndham says, "Meet any nice girls lately, see you soon," and then he asks Diane to dinner. I just found that a little odd that he would, well, in a way odd, but not that that Wyndham basically makes this overt threat to any person that Coop is close with, and then he asks Diane to dinner.
Not a defense to Cooper, but I think one thing that lines up is actually two scenes in season two. The first is when it's Dougie Milford's wedding, and obviously Cooper and Audrey, they've settled that they're just going to be friends, but he gets this insidious message from Wyndham Earle, but then he goes to this wedding as if nothing happened. But also the one that really I think stands out to me is that it's during the Wyndham Earle case. I think it's like it might even be when Pete Martell is like has the chessboards all lined up and ready to go. Or at least it's like during those events. But Cooper, he's like, oh, I can't stop thinking about Annie. Like I should be worried about this stuff, but I just can't get her out of my mind. So I think it's very telling that once again with Cooper, even though with his deductive techniques, that he has this weakness towards any woman that he has like a strong fixation towards. So I do get what you're saying, but I think it does fit in line with Cooper that he would just overlook this.
I think it more ties with the fact, well, not, I wouldn't say fact, that my speculation that Coop uses women to distract himself from his feelings. And it sounds so bad to say he uses women to distract himself, but he looks for outside comforts to supersede his anxieties and to deal, again, my motif, deal with the emotion rather than to feel the emotion.
I would agree with that because I think one thing that does fit in with this is that the next major event that he does after his dinner date with Diane is that he ventures out to Canada in an attempt to find Emmett, finds out that he has actually gone off to South America, and he actually fears that they're total strangers because they have not seen each other for about 20 plus years. And then when he returns home, he finds that everything's changed and he just feels so extraordinarily empty just from everything. And a couple months after that, he actually talks about how he feels bored in his profession. And he wants to test himself to the absolute limit to walk to the edge of the fire and risk it all. And also, I believe that he's, I don't know if I wrote this down for myself or what he said, but it's also to be careful what he wishes for. And I think that a lot of this, when it says test himself to the absolute limit, my thought was the chess game he had with Wyndham Earl, because that was a rivalry that he could never beat before. And also the fact that he was stalemating instead of confronting it. And to be fair, there were lives at stake, so I can't fault him for it. But I think the fact that he was like going for stalemate is also there's some though that just kind of fits in with what he's saying during these events in late 88.
Yes, I would say that it has a lot to do with that. And with my observation of Coop's tendency to flourish in stress environments. So he's craving the stress environment because that's stimulating. And because when he does not have a stress environment, he has space to self-reflect, which he does not like to do. And it also says something to Wyndham's influence and what Wyndham could see in Coop. That he wants to step up to the flame and test the limits, which is essentially what I would observe what Wyndham was doing, but with like the evil in oneself, that Wyndham was testing the limits of human ability, and that is where they have that parallel. Wyndham was bored, so Wyndham decided to do serial killing. And Coop is bored and he's trying to find his way through the world still. He's still trying to find his place in it and moving forward with that curiosity. But Wyndham's core is so different than Coop's core. It's like two sides of a coin where there's a lot of parallels to what you can see, but the lightness that Coop has in his spirit, even though he's been so trampled by his past, despite what's happened, speaks for his character.
I think one thing that I do take away from this, and it'll tie into what I say about early 1989, Boyne says to walk to the edge of the fire and risk it all. Now, I think a lot of people would think that that would be a correlation of fire walk with me in terms of what we hear as presented in the original series. But I just think of like actually more so fire as Hawk talks about in The Return, because when him and Frank Truman are sitting down, they're talking about the map that Hawk has. And he's talking about how fire is like, it's not really the malevolence, it's more so the intent. And also, I mean, it might be worth addressing why I've been mentioning the electricity parts throughout it, is that he refers to electricity as being the new fire. So I think a lot of this is how Cooper, he's tapping into something. And like I said, I don't think Scott Frost really had this actively in mind. I just think this retroactively fits in. But I think there's a way that electricity and now fire is being described here, that it is about the intent that Cooper has. And like we were saying before, is that Cooper, for all his keen intellect, that he is a very flawed man. And I think that when he's wants to be careful what he wishes for, this is something he probably should have been careful about before he actually said it to begin with. Because in early 1989, more specifically February 18th, he receives a letter about Wyndham about a test of skill. And 2 days later, Cooper's pondering his own destiny. He wonders if his destiny, what his destiny is, and he even wonders if it actually passed him. And he also dwells on the death of his mother, Marie, Caroline. He's mentioning specifically women. So I think this all ties to what we were saying before about the women in his life and how they factor into it. But yeah, I think that there's just something about the way he wants to be tested and how Wyndham is explicitly wanting to engage in a test of skill. And the thing is that I know we're getting into the original series at this point, but I'm thinking early in season two when Albert, he tells Cooper that Wyndham Earl has escaped, It's like, oh, that is concerning. But he's still deeply entrenched in the lore of Palmer murder. So this thing has actually come by pretty quickly for him in this test of skill. And it's not really the best time for him either.
No, but when else? When is a good time for a test of skill against Wyndham Earle?
I guess never, but I guess that since he wasn't, was he in, I mean, obviously he was in the FBI when Wyndham Earle escaped. Wasn't he suspended from the FBI like during the events when it really took into play?
He was at that point, but I feel like that had more to do with it being conventional to a TV series plot.
That is true. Yeah, because I know that Mark Frost, he's actually talked about where he said that looking back on it, he wishes that they just came roaring out of the gate with the Wyndham Earle arc rather than just meandering for a few episodes after the Laura Palmer murder was resolved. I think that him and the writers were just really concerned of where do we take the show and what do we do and how can we surpass this thing that became such a landmark in 1990. But actually, I guess to conclude on it is that the last thing we get is on February 24th of 1989, where he's told about the Laura Palmer murder at 6 a.m. And of course, we get the part at 11:30 a.m. where he says he's entering the town of Twin Peaks, thus ending My Life in Tapes. But I think that another thing that's worth addressing is that we were talking a bit about stuff in Fire Walk with Me relative to the Teresa Banks murder and Philip Jeffries. But was there anything else we should keep in mind about the events from that movie and how it correlates with My Life, My Tapes at this point?
I think that the one thing I would really stress about when it comes to that, and in tying with My Life, My Tapes, is the whole bit with Coop when he's telling Gordon about this dream he had. So, in the context of this prophetic nature that he has, and that scene with the security tape before Jeffries comes on scene, I remember looking at that and say and thinking to myself, he's replicating what was in his dream. He is trying to prove himself wrong. And then when he does see himself stuck on the security tape and then he cries out for Gordon, I think that is a part of this nature of trying to take these prophetic dreams and prevent them.
That's actually, wow. I mean, I have to give a little bit of time to really let that sink in because what I thought about more so was it was actually one of the few, if not the only, present day scenes in 1989. It's when Cooper's talking to Albert, saying, like, you're going to be part of the next case. And Albert's like, all right, let's test for the record. Who is she? He says that it's a blonde high school girl addicted to drugs and she's crying out for help. And of course, Albert's being Albert, saying that's half the high school girls in America. But the thing is that they segue with Cooper saying that she's right now creating a great abundance of food. And we cut to Laura at the Double R Diner where her and Shelly are getting ready to help with Meals on Wheels. And granted, that doesn't quite go according to plan, but there's something said that there is this balance of Wyndham Earl's on his mind, but also he has this intuition of Laura like within less than a week before she's killed.
I mean, I would say that he's had a connection to Laura, at least on a prophetic dream type of level, for a great while. It just became a connection after Teresa Banks's murder.
I can't remember the date offhand, but I know that in the secret diary that Laura, she does talk about having a dream of a dancing man and there's an old man there. So we're at least once we get to the late 80s that there's at least a, if there was a connection before, those two dreams, the fact that they're both basically sharing the dreams before Cooper has it in the original series, there is something to be said there.
Yes. There's some sort of woven destiny there where both of their threads were becoming intertwined at that point, in if we're going to take the metaphor of the weavers of destiny. But their cloth was sewn together, at least by that point.
One thing to end this episode, just because we're talking about the relationship of Cooper and Laura, is that I maintain that the very last scene we see in all of Twin Peaks, I actually think of the scene, the very last scene, Fire Walk With Me, where Laura gets her angel and then Cooper's there for her. I have this mindset that, you know, when I think of part 14, I think of when Annie goes to see the firemen, is that we have that, what I think is the most important part in all of Twin Peaks, where he's looking up the ceiling, he sees that iconic homecoming photo of Laura, and then there's the angel, and then there's the mirrored angel. And I think that the angel we see on the right is clearly the angel we see in Fire Walk With Me, but the fact that the other one's mirrored, I view it as that, in my opinion, there's two realities that overlap in Twin Peaks, and that in the end, even though Cooper tremendously screws up in Part 18, that she still gets that angel. And I think it's very telling that, in my opinion, she still gets that angel, but Cooper, not that he can't change, but if we're going with this last scene, that he is kind of just stuck in the Black Lodge. So that's kind of my stance on how I view that relationship with the two and kind of how Cooper ties into all this at large.
I mean, I wouldn't say he's stuck in the Black Lodge. I would say he is stuck. He's stuck in his own mind, where he cannot accept reality as it is, to a point where he changed it to the detriment of the freedom of this woman. Laura was free, and he took that from her in order to save her.
I think of that scene in Part 18, it's the closing credits when Laura's whispering into Dale's ear. We've brought up micro expressions before, but I just think of like the look that Kyle MacLachlan has, where he feels very uncomfortable. It's like very disconcerted. So I think that these two things are kind of emblematic of what we see in Part 2 when Laura's whispering in his ear. And the thing is that she shows that she revealed the her face and like the white energy that exudes from it. But then Cooper just has this very disconcerted look that's going on. So I know it's a little bit of a bit of a bad ending, if you will, for Cooper, but I still think that Laura, she still ascends from the Black Lodge. She still gets her angel. And that Cooper, once again, for all of his intellect, that there's still things that he's just like, he just has such tunnel vision about. And unfortunately, it is something that's like to a detriment far beyond our comprehensions.
Yeah, and I would say that it has a lot more to deal with rather than intellect, emotional intellect, and his inability to accept tragedy and his inability to accept the instances that happen to his life where he can't move on. And that is at the detriment to other people and to creating or having this alternate reality completely be made. But he is a good man. He is a flawed man.
I 100% agree, and I think that covers everything about Dell Cooper before Twin Peaks. Normally, because I ask this for everyone else, is there anywhere on social media or anything online you'd like to plug or anyone can find you on?
Nope, I'm not very much into the social media scene, but hey, for all those listening, plug this everywhere. Go and tweet the episode out and plug it in all of your social medias. This is a very fun thing to do and a very fun thing to experience.
But no, I want to thank you again for coming on, Sabrina, because I knew that this was a huge, huge episode.
It's very fun to go through. I love the characters of Twin Peaks, and I love the intricacies of them and everything that they go through and everything that they represent and just evolve with.
Together, forever.